This is WBUR.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The Bush administration is talking tough again, and Pentagon hawks are threatening regime change again, this time in Iran, and not necessarily by military means, if the Islamic Republic threatens U.S. interests. But is destabilization of the Iranian government, which is accused of terror ties and nuclear ambitions, a good idea, or will U.S. intervention only make the situation worse? Tonight on Point, back to the axis of evil, putting the squeeze on Iran. We begin with the hot American conversation over potential U.S. intervention in Iran. Stephen Weissman is chief diplomatic correspondent for the New York Times. I asked him to describe the latest on the great Iran debate in Washington.
There was supposed to be a meeting today, an interagency meeting in the administration, to decide on possible next steps toward Iran, but it was put off because of some actions Iran took over the last several days, including over the weekend. Apparently, the reports have come into Washington that Iran has arrested some al-Qaeda operatives who were working in its territory. But the problem is the administration is not sure who they are and how significant that is. They know these operatives have not been turned over to anybody. And the administration people I talked to say that even Iran is not sure who they arrested.
But in the effort that they made to arrest them is an indication, I guess, that Washington has Tehran's attention. The meeting, interagency meeting today of top U.S. officials was to be, as I understand it, to discuss whether to suspend further diplomatic contacts with Iran. That's pretty high stakes.
It is, but nothing ever gets decided permanently. The United States has had periodic contacts which have been secret. Until recently, they weren't really discussed openly by the United States. But they've been going on since the war in Afghanistan because Iran has actually, while it's driving American policymakers crazy on many fronts, has actually cooperated with the United States in both the Afghan and even in the Iraq wars by staying aloof and not making as much trouble as they could. So there are those in the administration who feel the contacts have been valuable. They're not a reward to Iran. They're something that gets us something in return. However, the most recent one, which was supposed to have taken place a week or two ago, was canceled. And instead, Iran was told, you better get moving on this al-Qaeda situation. Some Americans believe that those al-Qaeda operatives in Iran may have been responsible for the bombings in Saudi Arabia earlier this month. And Iran does seem to have taken some steps. But if they don't, those talks may be off temporarily. But there will always be those in the administration who advocate dealing with Iran, talking to them, and trying to get them to do at least some things that would be helpful to us.
Steve Weissman, stepping back here, what exactly does Washington want? Iran has a democratically elected government led by President Mohammad Khatami, but it also has hardline clerics who really pull the strings. President Bush has talked about regime change. Does he have in mind something like what happened in Iraq?
Some real hawkish members of the administration have that in mind, but that is not yet policy. And it would be much harder to pull off in Iran than it was in Iraq. Iran is a more prosperous country. And there's also another problem, which is that across the board, whether it's the secular moderates or the clerics who are very fanatical, there's a consensus in Iran that it still should pursue its nuclear weapons program. So regime change might not bring about that kind of change in Iran.
Is that what has the U.S. most fixated? We've heard three things, as I can see. We've heard the charge of support of terrorism. We've heard the concern over Iran's nuclear program and whether that might lead to nuclear weapons there. And we've heard concern about Iranian interference in Iraq as the U.S. tries to rebuild there. What's the top concern at the White House?
Those are the big three, but I would say the top concern at the White House is the nuclear threat. Because if Iran develops nuclear weapons capability in the next year or two, and the fear is that they're on their way to doing so, and then at the last minute will simply walk away from their treaty obligations and announce that they have nukes, that would introduce a frightening new element throughout the entire Middle East. It would not be inconceivable that in short order, Saudi Arabia would also acquire nuclear weapons, which it could very easily do from Pakistan. And then, of course, Israel, which everybody believes and knows to have nuclear weapons, would come into the equation, and you'd have a nuclearized array of enemy nations in the most volatile, unstable part of the world. That's the prospect that frightens the United States even more than the terrorism threat and the instability of Iraq.
So, Steve Weissman, what are the battle lines in Washington over how to address this? Is it the same kind of moderate versus hard bar split we saw over Iraq, State Department versus Pentagon?
It's pretty analogous to that. The hardliners feel that confrontation with Iran is the way to go, and also supporting opposition groups that would try and foment an uprising in Iran is the way to go. And the moderates in the administration at the State Department argue that dialogue with Iran, while not perfect, has yielded some results and is more likely to change Iranian behavior than any kind of fantasy that we can change it by force.
And is anyone talking about changing it by force, about military intervention?
You know, we're in this funny phase. That is not the current policy of the administration, and it is not even in the offing. But it's certainly something that the hardliners, especially at the Pentagon, want to be considered on an urgent basis. And there are some in Israel and other places who share that view. Israelis are very concerned, for instance, about the nuclear weapons capability of Iran. So it's possible that before the end of the year, this will come to a head. But a lot of betting now is that this president can't afford to embark on yet another war before the next election cycle. And most likely, the can will get kicked down the road until after the election.
Though there is some hot language. Donald Rumsfeld was saying just last week that there was no question that Iran was linked to al-Qaeda. Is there consensus on that, Stephen Weissman?
There is not a consensus on the link to al-Qaeda. Well, let's put it this way. It is known and has been known from the beginning that al-Qaeda operatives are operating in Iran. But guess what? They're also operating in Pakistan, which is our ally and which is a government that we're supporting. And in Pakistan, we say the al-Qaeda operatives are operating there independent of the government's ability to crack down on them. Well, Iran is saying, hey, we can't crack down on them either. They're operating in the mountains of the south or the north, and our writ doesn't necessarily extend there. The question is, we're believing that that's the case for Pakistan, and the debate is whether or not we should believe it with Iran.
If President Bush's inner circle doesn't really want a military conflict here, what do they hope to achieve by raising the pressure on Tehran?
To get their attention and to keep engaging them in dialogue so that they can, A, realize the danger to them of not cooperating, but also maybe realize the benefits of cooperating with improved relations with the United States. And there is some evidence that even some of the clerical hardliners are starting to say it's time to try and improve relations with the United States. Former President Rafsanjani, who, when he was running the show, and he still has influence, was very anti-U.S., said a month or so ago that there ought to be a referendum in Iran about whether or not to improve relations with the United States. That was considered by many analysts to be a very bold step, because talk of improving the relationship with the United States until now has been a criminal offense.
So there's an opening, but whether the United States is going in the direction of that opening or not is still unclear. Stephen Weissman, thank you very much for joining us.
A pleasure. Thank you.
Stephen Weissman is chief diplomatic correspondent with the New York Times. He spoke with us from Washington. Hardliners in the Bush administration argue that the U.S. needs to put the squeeze on the mullahs in Iran. They are said to be harboring al-Qaeda leaders. They are feared to be developing a nuclear weapons arsenal and meddling in post-war Iraq. The mullahs need to listen up, hawks in the administration say, or get a taste of regime change in Tehran. But critics say that the weight of evidence does not confirm a grave Iranian threat, and that an attempt at regime change, even without military means, could backfire. Tonight on Point, putting the squeeze on Iran, Can you imagine America, the great Satan of the Islamic Revolution, being welcomed as a liberator in Tehran? Do you believe the Bush administration's description of the Iranian threat? And will tough talk from Washington help or hurt the future of democracy in Iran? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Genevieve Abdo, co-author of Answering Only to God, Faith and Freedom in 21st Century Iran. She was correspondent in Iran for The Guardian from 1998 to 2001. Good evening and welcome back, Genevieve Abdo.
Good evening. It's great to be back.
It's good to have you. Also with us from Montgomery, Alabama, is Patrick Clausen, Deputy Director of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Good evening and welcome, Patrick Clausen.
Glad to be with you.
Good to have you. Genevieve Abdo, let me turn to you first. Tehran is clearly hearing the clamor in Washington. Is it having an effect? We hear that there were just today arrests of al-Qaeda leaders there. Is the rising heat from the United States having Washington's desired effect in Tehran?
Well, I think certainly on the issue of al-Qaeda, I mean, Iran has responded. But I think we must not forget that the Iranians have never supported al-Qaeda. And this is where the confusion comes in. People assume that because the Iranian government's long standing for Hezbollah, the terrorist organization in Lebanon, which is fighting the Israeli occupation in Palestine, that because of Iran's support for Hezbollah, that automatically means that they support al-Qaeda, when in fact al-Qaeda has a completely different agenda, and they're a Sunni Muslim organization, not a Shiite one. So this is an issue that Iran can easily compromise on with the United States and reach some sort of agreement.
But will that be enough? Of course, there's also the issue of Washington's charges of meddling in post-war Iraq and of development of nuclear weapons. Can Tehran compromise on these?
I think the two that you mentioned are more difficult for Iran. On the nuclear issue, they believe that developing a nuclear program is definitely within their interest. And as your earlier guest, Steve Wiseman, noted, certainly there are countries in the region with advanced nuclear programs, Pakistan and Israel. So Iran believes that it's perfectly within their strategic interest to develop a nuclear program. And so on this issue, I would believe that it would be much harder to get any sort of concessions from the Iranians in the kind of, you know, swift speed that we've seen in their response to the al-Qaeda issue.
Patrick Clausen, let me get you just on that point of the nukes, and we know there are others, but do you think that the rising temperature of the conversation in Washington is having an effect in Tehran? Can we tell yet? Does it need to go higher? Does the threat need to become more acute to get Tehran's attention?
Well, as Genevieve was saying, the nuclear program is one that's got quite a lot of support inside Iran. And so if we're going to persuade the Iranians that they really have to live up to their obligations under the non-proliferation treaty, then we're going to have to turn up the temperature and, furthermore, involve others. And that's why the United States government has been pressing so hard to see that the International Atomic Energy Agency, or IAEA, declare that Iran is not compliant with its obligations under this non-proliferation treaty, or NPT. Iran is the only member country of the NPT. Now that North Korea has dropped out, Iran's the only one that is actively developing nuclear weapons.
And how far do you think the range of U.S. threats should go, Patrick Clausen? Does it, in effect already, include a threat of military intervention in Iran?
Well, ambiguity has often been useful in these kinds of threats, and I don't think the United States should be very precise about what it's doing, but it wouldn't hurt if we darkly hinted that after all, what the Israelis did to the Osirak reactor in Iraq,
set
back the Iraqi nuclear program. I should say the Israelis bombed it in 1981 before it started operation. That set back the Iraqi nuclear program for many years, and you just sort of darkly hint about that and imply that somebody might do something about the Iranian program, that could have some effect on getting the Iranians to realize this is a big issue.
Well, there is a lot of dark hinting going on out of Washington right now. We're talking this hour about Washington putting the squeeze on Iran, talking tough, talking even regime change. We'll come back and look at the politics there. Why is Iran suddenly Washington's new target? Are you ready to support more regime change in the Middle East? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Washington, putting the squeeze on Iran, talking tough, talking even regime change. Can you imagine America, Iran's great Satan in the Islamic Revolution, being welcomed as a liberator in Tehran somehow? Can the UN bring peace and prosperity to Iraq without Iran's compliance? And for Washington to meet its goals in Iraq, in the Middle East, do Tehran's ruling clerics have to go? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guests tonight are Patrick Clawson, Deputy Director of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, joining us tonight from Montgomery, Alabama, and Genevieve Abdo, joining us from Washington, co-author of Answering Only to God, Faith and Freedom in 21st Century Iran. Genevieve Abdo, how about it on this broader point? It's all at the level of conversation at the moment, at least as far as we know, and Tehran is responding and taking action, arrests today. But there's talk of the Pentagon supporting the destabilization of the Iranian government and the overthrow of the powers that be in Tehran. A, can you imagine that working and how? And B, what kind of reaction from the people of Iran?
I can't imagine that working in Iran. Iran is a completely different situation than Iraq. First of all, the clerics are very much in power in a way that Saddam wasn't, because he ruled by repression alone. And also, I think that one thing that is forgotten in this whole discussion is that despite whatever Iranians might think of the conservatives within the regime, and we all know that they're not very popular, these are the hardliners.
There's a lot of yearning for more democratic freedom there.
There's yearning for freedom. However, what most Iranians agree upon is that they don't want any sort of or any form of U.S. intervention. And I really think it's safe to say that they would oppose U.S. intervention far more than, you know, they even oppose the hardliners within the regime. And I think that, you know, this really must be kept in mind when the United States decides what form of policy they will you know, devise in terms of Iran.
So, Patrick Clawson, in that case, are the dark hints from Washington seen as credible, or are they seen as pure theatrics? Do you think the mullahs can sit back in Tehran and say they are never going to destabilize us, throw us out with a good outcome, and they know it? We don't have to take this seriously.
Well, the hardliners in Iran go ape every time that the United States does anything with opposition groups, and that suggests that they may read the situation differently.
Hmm.
For instance, there's this very small opposition group called the Mujahideen, who I would say have no future in Iran, but the Iranian leaders seem to get very upset every time that we talk to them. And right now, Senator Brownback is proposing in Congress that the United States help Iranian Americans broadcast in Persian language to satellite television to Iran, and that the United States bring community leaders from Iran here to learn about how our democracy works. And the Iranian leaders, again, are getting very upset at these ideas.
Are you suggesting
they're sensitive?
Are you suggesting by that the Iranian people might, in fact, welcome a U.S. intervention in Iran's politics that led to a fall of the mullahs, that you don't fear the allergic reaction that Genevieve Abdo describes, and that many of us remember from 1979, the thousands and thousands of the street chanting against that era of U.S. intervention?
I think the Iranians are very eager to get rid of the mullahs, but they want to do it themselves. But the kind of things that Senator Brownback is proposing, which is to say more television programs in Persian extolling the virtues of democracy and explaining how the world works rather than the highly censored Iranian television, or bringing community leaders from Iran here. Those kinds of things, I think, would be reasonably well accepted in Iran, although certainly there'd be hardliners who'd be very suspicious about those things. In other words, encouraging more exchanges between the peoples of the two countries is something which drives the hardliners crazy, and so therefore something that we ought to think about doing more of.
Genevieve Abdo, George Bush himself used this phrase regime change again in regard to Iran. Patrick Clawson's describing activities sort of well within the traditional kind of propaganda give and take of different countries. Can you imagine that kind of soft outreach being perceived as a threat by the mullahs in Tehran, being effective, being welcomed by Iranians?
It's definitely perceived by the mullahs as a threat, as Patrick explained. However, I'm very skeptical as to whether this is going to inspire some sort of internal rebellion, because let's not forget, Iranians already now have, and they have for many years, that many of them have satellite dishes. They have access to foreign radios. They have access to American film. When I was in Iran, they knew every day what was being reported in the British press. They read the internet. So we're not talking about a country that's closed to the world. And I think that Iranians in general are very, very cynical about this kind of programming that has traditionally been, you know, from the Voice of America and the kind of media propaganda approach that was employed during the Cold War. They're very, very skeptical about this.
Is it possible then that U.S. efforts could actually set back democracy reformers inside Iran, indigenous reformers?
Absolutely. I think that that as I mentioned, we have already seen the strengthening of the hardliners as the rhetoric has escalated and as a result of the war in Iraq. And this is perfect evidence, as far as the hardliners are concerned, for Iran not to trust the Americans. And certainly this is how they're playing it in Iran now, if you analyze their statements. So I think that, in fact, all of this rhetoric is really backfiring.
What about that, Patrick Claussen? The risk of backfire, if Iran, with its own history of relations with the U.S., not always happy, if Iranians see this as meddling on the U.S. part, could it end up back in Washington's lap in a way that would please no one?
Well, in fact, it's been foreign statements about the imprisonment of reform leaders, which has been the only thing which has been effective at getting them out of jail. And so what we find is that when foreigners get interested and concerned about the cause of reform in Iran, that the Iranian hardliners realize they have to back off. And similarly, when George Bush talked about Iran as being part of the axis of evil, we had Iranian hardliners like the former President Rafsanjani, who, as Mr. Weissman pointed out, is a very important figure in Iran. He criticized Mr. Bush strongly, but at the same time he said that it was important that Iran be prudent and to not give any excuse for the Americans to go after Iran. And that has been now a powerful argument that can be used by people as to why Iran has to back off a little bit. So in fact, I would say that the harsh language used by the United States has been effective at helping reform movement and at helping change the debate in Iran so that realists in Iran realize that they have to back off a little.
And what about the nuclear weapons program, alleged program there, that by all accounts, both moderates and Islamic hardliners are determined to continue? Patrick Claussen, if the United States achieves some level of influence with this talk barrage, at least, or even more than that, if it doesn't get rid of the nukes, which Steve Weissman tells us are the number one priority, is it worth it? Or how do we ultimately crack that nut?
Well, we have for a long time had the hope that a fundamental change was going to come to Iran before Iran's nuclear program succeeded, and so we spent many years trying to delay that program. It looks now that like we've lost that bet, and so we need to come up with a plan B about what to do about the nuclear issue. And that's going to be a tough one, and that's one of the reasons why there is some talk about the possibility of preempting the program, which I think would be an awfully difficult thing to do and would really hurt this reform movement badly. But
you mean if the U.S. went in with I don't know, fighter jets and took out a nuclear plant?
Correct.
That would set reform back.
I would think that would set the reform back. It'd be a real price we'd have to pay. But we have to find some way to persuade the Iranian hardliners that they really got to freeze this new program and not bring it any further. And there, the Europeans have got discussions going on with the Iranians about the nuclear issue. And this is a good opportunity for the Europeans to show that they're serious about enforcing the Non-Proliferation Treaty and seeing that countries that have signed on to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, like Iran, observe it. So I think that we've got to put a little heat on the Europeans to say, hey, you said you'd take care of this problem with the Iranians. What are you doing? You say you've got dialogue with the Iranians about this issue.
So how about it?
What's that dialogue producing?
Patrick Claussen, Geneva Abdo, stand by. I've got a lot of callers who want to join us. Bonnie is calling from Madison. Hi, Bonnie. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Well, I think my question might be more pertinent for Genevieve.
Okay.
I've read her book.
Terrific book. I never understood Iran until I read it.
I in light of Rumsfeld saying telling the Shia clerics to back off Iraq, it's my understanding that the Iraqi shrine cities of Najaf and Karbala are
in Iraq.
Sacred,
mm-hmm.
to the Iranians as they are to the Iraqis, and there have long been ties between the Shia of Iraq and Iran. So it's it seems to me that there are links that go back centuries to Mesopotamia and Persia.
Are you saying, Bonnie, that the Iranians can't back off because their religion ties them into shrine cities inside Iraq?
That's just one factor. I mean, maybe all of these other factors come into play, too, but I don't think the interest in Iraq is just sudden, at least not from a religious perspective, and I wondered what Genevieve would say to that.
Yeah, great. Thanks for your call, Bonnie. Jenny, how about it? How would you imagine Iran is looking at Iraq now, both in pure national power terms and in religious terms?
Well, that's a really important question, and I think that that now Iran actually has a card to play with the Americans because, you know, as we've all been reading, there is now a great sort of connection between the Shiites in Iraq and Iran that hasn't existed before. And really, this has been the long-time dream of Shiites in Iraq. Even though the Shiites in Iraq are quite different from the Shiites in Iran.
The dream being that
there could be this sort of Gom Najaf access or corridor whereby theologians in Gom, which is the center for religious learning in Iran, where they could have some sort of unity with the clerics in Najaf.
So the Shiite realm would sort of go right across the border. Its natural shape there.
Exactly. And certainly now that one of the leading clerics in Iraq, Ayatollah Hakim, now that he is back in Iraq and he's a real player now, you know, he was actually in exile in Iran for over 10 years. So if nothing else, he owes the Iranians a great debt, which I'm sure that they will, you know, try to cash in on.
So Jenny, it's one thing, and one can well imagine Iranians wanting to have access to Shiite shrines in Iraq. But if you look at the Iranian government in Tehran, is it salivating over the chance to meddle in Iraq's internal affairs?
Well, I don't think that it wants to meddle necessarily in the sense that they want Iranians to go and have some sort of seat in the government. This is really about religion, I think, and what political power is derived from religion. And the Iranians want to have some sort of influence in a theological sense in these centers. And, of course, as we know from what Hakim and many clerics have said in Iraq, their views on religion, they're going to play a great role in how they think a post-war government should be formed in Iraq.
Patrick Claussen, Donald Rumsfeld says, no way, no how, Iraq is going to turn out an Islamic republic like Iran. You see, like all of us, that the tides of Shiite belief flowing back and forth between those countries and inside Iraq itself, inside Iran. How does the U.S. ultimately deal with that?
Well, the majority of Iraqi Shiites are very proud of their religion and want to see their religious principles practiced freely without any interference by the government. But they also believe strongly that clerics should not be the ones running the government. The most senior Shia cleric in Iraq, Ayatollah Sistani, is actually an Iranian, born and brought up in Iran, and he is somebody who is strongly opposed to the system in Iran where religion has become politicized and where clerics run the government. And so, in fact, I think it's wonderful for the United States if Shias in Iraq are training more clerics in the traditional Shia approach, which is to say that clerics should not be the ones running the government and that the government should be generally inspired by the morality of religion, but that it would be a mistake for religion and the state to be so closely associated that, as many thinkers in Iran have been pointing out, that this is something which works to the disadvantage of both sides.
So as you know the situation in Iran, can you imagine the U.S., in partnership with Iraqis, achieving the kind of state that Washington would like in Iraq with this current government in power and mullahs in power in Tehran? Can they live side by side?
Well, I think it'll be a destabilizing for one of the two sides because a free in Iraq, which is working successfully, is going to have a lot of clerics there who say that this is how Islam and the state ought to be related, where the state is run democratically and religion and the state are respectful of each other, but that the clerics don't control the state. And that's a model which is very attractive to people throughout Iran. Look, already what we see is in every little village in Iran, people are starting to give their religious alms, which Muslims are obliged to give, in the name of Ayatollah Sistani, the Iraqi cleric, and in part because Sistani is somebody who's not liked by the hardliners who run the Iranian government, and because people like Sistani's vision, which is the separation of the state and and the religion.
And still, we hear there, in your assessment, these things can't live side by side. That brings us back around to regime changes. We'll come to Jason's calling from Boston. Hi, Jason. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Sure.
I just have a. I just want to say one of the points made was, can we trust the information out of Washington? Mm-hmm. And as for my work, I deal with the general public, and I hear every day people having concerns that there still hasn't been any chemical weapons found in Iraq. Given that, how can we trust the current administration's intelligence on just about anything might be going on in Iran?
So you're skeptical of the claims about links to Al-Qaeda, the nuclear program, the works, Jason?
The claims to Al-Qaeda, I think, are pretty self, they're pretty self-described. I don't think Al-Qaeda actually works with any government after Afghanistan. I think it would be suicide to work with Al-Qaeda after the Afghanistan model.
Jason, thanks for your call. Patrick Klussen, I guess that raises the issue. Suddenly we've got this hot conversation in Washington that seems, in a way, possibly beyond the temperature of the American public at large. The country
Correct.
Is not revved up on this.
Right.
Can the Bush administration afford to hit the gas on the national conversation again and ask Americans to kind of, stand up and get riled about Iran and get ready to do something on this?
Well, that's going to be a real tough one. And one of the reasons why the administration has not been so eager to see this issue heat up so quickly, they've been planning to gather a lot more information through the International Atomic Energy Agency about the nuclear program and form a pretty broad consensus with the Europeans about Iran's nuclear program before they turned up the pressure on the Iranians so that they can come to the American people and the international community and say, look, folks, this one is not a question about what's there. It's a question about what do we do about what everybody agrees is there.
Patrick Klussen, I know we have to let you go. I want to thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Patrick Klussen joined us from Montgomery, Alabama. He's deputy director of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Geneva Abdo, stand by. We're going to come back. We've got a lot more questions here. We'll be joined by more voices. You can join the conversation as well. Do you trust Washington's description of the Iran threat? Is it credible? Is it believable? And can Washington handle another regime change project just now in the Middle East? Do U.S. threats help or hurt Iran's movement toward democracy? We're talking about Washington putting the squeeze on Iran, talking tough, talking even regime change. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined by Geneva Abdo. She's co-author of Answering Only to God, Faith and Freedom in 21st Century Iran. She's former correspondent in Iran for The Guardian from 1998 to 2001. Join us, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Make a bid for the news.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Washington putting the squeeze on Iran, talking tough, talking even regime change in Tehran. You can join the conversation. Can you imagine America, Iran's great Satan, being welcomed, intervening in Tehran? Are you ready to support more regime change in the Middle East? We're at 1-800-423-8255. We're joined tonight by Geneva Abdo, co-author of Answering Only to God, and now from Washington by Kenneth Timmerman. He's founder and executive director of the Foundation for Democracy in Iran. Good evening and welcome, Kenneth Timmerman.
Good evening. Thanks for having me on, Tom.
Thanks for joining us. As I understand it, Kenneth Timmerman, your group is dedicated to the proposition of regime change in Tehran. Is that right?
Well, since we were set up in 1995, we have been trying to promote the cause of the democracy movement inside Iran and suggesting to people here in Washington that there is actually a very large group of people inside Iran who would like to see dramatic changes in the way that the government is run.
But would they like to see American intervention to bring those changes about? And could that intervention bring the positive changes about in that regard?
Well, I don't think that U.S. military intervention is something that is on the table today.
I guess we're not talking exclusively military intervention. There seems to be a whole gamut or range of potentials there. You tell us what kind of intervention might be helpful, if any.
Yeah, the kind of thing that I have heard Iranians ask for, and Iranian pro-democracy groups inside, and some of their people come back and forth to the United States. Some of them have paid a very high price for that and have wound up in jail as a result. But what we hear when we talk to these people is that they would like a number of things from the United States. We could help, for instance, by providing some funds for printing presses, for communications inside Iran. We could be helpful by providing some training to their people in organizing techniques. We could be helpful by stepping up the rhetorical support, the public diplomacy support for democratic change or democratic change inside Iran. These are things which might not appear terribly revolutionary to people, but they would make a big difference to Iranians.
And further down the range of possibilities, there are those in the Pentagon who are calling for armed intervention. Do you favor that or not, Kenneth Timmerman?
Well, I don't think at this point that armed intervention is a serious option that's on the table. It's something that is always there looking in the background should it become necessary. And it could become necessary if there is overwhelming evidence, as Patrick Clausen was mentioning earlier, of an active and dangerous Iranian nuclear weapons program. It could become necessary if the ties between Iran and al-Qaeda are shown to be active and dangerous. So those are things that I would say are, we have to consider. Just keep those in mind.
Genevieve Abdo, here's another voice in Washington saying, let's get American hands in there and help democracy get off the ground in Iran. How do you hear this with all your experience in Iran, your time living there, Genevieve?
During the years that I lived in Iran, every time there was any endorsement from Washington toward the reform movement, the reformers would hold a press conference and basically escalate their anti-American rhetoric and say, we have nothing to do with Washington, we don't want their approval, and we're not, you know, part of any sort of U.S.-led campaign to create democracy in Iran. And I think that it's fair to say that that kind of pattern would certainly be repeated. Because as you mentioned earlier in the program, Tom, let's not forget that the 1950 CIA-backed coup in Iran, which brought the Shah to power, many historians would argue that this actually led to the Islamic Revolution. It took maybe 20 years for this backlash to happen, but this was the Iranian response to U.S. intervention in their country. They actually had a revolution.
So how do you interpret what you hear from Patrick Clausen tonight, what you're hearing from Kenneth Timmerman? Do you think they just don't know the situation there, or they've got a bead on something that you don't know about? Or do they have another an ulterior motive that we're not hip to?
Well, I think that the whole issue of Iran in Washington is highly politicized, perhaps more than U.S. policy toward any other country. You have basically very clearly defined groups from exiled Iranians who want democracy and want some sort of change in Iran so they can return there, to pro-Israeli groups, and to conservatives within the administration who are misguided in their approach and strategy, but who firmly believe that the mullahs have to go. And I think also most of this discussion forgets about the whole religious importance, you know, the important role that the clerics play in Iran. You can't just have regime change there and expect the clerics to disappear.
But can a sort of secular Iraqi government that Washington might accept and Tehran as we know it live side by side, Genevieve Abdo?
Well, I think that it's also a miscalculation of Iranian politics to assume that Iranians want a secular government. I mean, during the years that I was there, some of the most radical students told me that they want a government that respects human rights, that is pluralistic, but that also takes into account their Islamic values. Now, they didn't say that this should be an Islamic state, but they said that any new government should have some sort of Islamic framework. So there again, I think there's a false assumption, a misunderstanding of what Iranians want.
But does that mean the United States and Iran are on a collision course?
I think so. I think that through dialogue, some of these issues can certainly be sorted out if there's an exchange underway. If the U.S., for example, tells the Iranians, okay, we will release your assets that have been frozen since the 79 revolution. We will lift trade sanctions, and then you must stop your support of terrorism and at least allow monitors and surprise inspections of your nuclear facilities. So this is the kind of dialogue that could happen that would reduce the threat that's perceived by the Bush administration.
Steve's calling. Welcome, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I think it's important that the United States stay involved in the Near East, especially in Iraq now that, everything's falling apart there, to replace Saddam's dogmatic regime with a religious dogmatic regime is replacing one religion with another.
So what should we do about Iran, if anything, Steve?
I don't know if I'm ready to go for a military intervention yet.
But you're suggesting the United States needs to stay deeply involved, even in Iran. Or do I misread you?
I think you misread me. I'm saying we need to be involved in Iraq and keep Iran out of Iraq.
Oh, I see. Keep Iraq's borders kind of sealed up against Iranian influence. Tall order, given that they're right next door. But how about it, Kenneth Timmerman? Can that be done?
Well, I don't think it can be done, certainly not very easily. And I think what Patrick Lawson said earlier is absolutely dead on center. A free, democratic Iraq with representative government is going to present a tremendous challenge to this clique in Tehran that's ruling, a radical Islamic clique that is ruling, I believe, at variance with the will of the Iranian people. Genevieve mentioned something earlier that I think is worthwhile coming back to a bit. She mentioned that the U.S. should have a dialogue, and we could have a useful dialogue with Iranian reformers over a number of issues, such as their support for terrorism and such as their nuclear weapons program.
And push some frozen money back their way.
Yeah, but you know, this ignores the fact that the various U.S. administrations, first Bush administration, the administration of Bill Clinton, and this administration have been having a dialogue with the Iranian government, and it's been on precisely those issues. And the dialogue over the past 15 years has gone precisely nowhere.
So does that mean that regime change is a bottom-line requirement to you, Kenneth Timmerman?
Well, what it means is that if this regime is going to accept the kind of things that the United States finds unacceptable, if they are going to change in the ways, I should say, that we want them to change, if they're going to give up terrorism, if they're going to give up absolute clerical rule, they will no longer be the same regime that they are today, and you will have effectively regime change, which is why they're not going to make any concessions to us.
Jenny Abdo, can you imagine an evolution of this sort of funny tandem ruling groups in Tehran that would bring them into a zone where they were acceptable to themselves and to Washington?
Yes, I think that certainly that's something that the direction that the country is headed in. But I don't think we're going to see that in the next 2 to 5 years. There is definitely a gradual process toward reforming the system. And certainly the reformers expect this to happen in the next 20 years. And even despite all the repression and the crackdown that we've seen over the last few years, this movement will continue. And so there's every reason to believe that Iran will change eventually.
But that's not the Washington timetable, it wouldn't seem.
No, exactly. Certainly Washington wants this to happen quickly. And I believe that because there is some sort of democratic movement in Iran, this even gives Iranians more conviction that they should do this kind of reform themselves without U.S. intervention.
Well, as we speak tonight, it doesn't look like these two timetables are jiving at all. But what a lot of insight we've got. Jenny Abdo, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Genevieve Abdo is co-author of Answering Only to God, Faith and Freedom in 21st Century Iran. And Kenneth Timmerman, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Kenneth Timmerman is founder and executive director of the Foundation for Democracy in Iran. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, Donald Rumsfeld addresses the continued instability in Iraq. This is On Point. It has been a violent couple of days in Iraq. Two American soldiers were killed earlier today and nine wounded when an army unit was fired upon in the city of Fallujah, 30 miles west of Baghdad. Yesterday, another soldier was killed during an ambush in northern Iraq. The violence came even as Iraq's civilian administrator, Paul Bremer, said yesterday that troops have done a great deal to reestablish stability. But Bremer acknowledged there is still a lot to do, there's no doubt. Today, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld defended the Bush administration against those who charge that it may have won the war in Iraq but is losing the peace. Speaking at a meeting of the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington, Rumsfeld said in days following the Revolutionary War, Americans went through a comparable period of unrest and instability. Here are excerpts from his speech.
Looting, crime, mobs storming buildings, breakdown of government structures and institutions that maintained civil order, rampant inflation caused by the lack of a stable currency, supporters of the former regime roaming the streets, countryside whose fate has yet to be determined, regional tensions between the North and the South, delays, bickering, false starts in an effort to establish a new government. If these problems sound familiar, they should. They are the historian's descriptions of the conditions here in America in 1783, in the period after our nation's war for independence. Those early years of our young republic were characterized by chaos and confusion. There was crime and looting and a lack of organized police force. The issue of competing paper currencies by various states led to inflation and popular discontent. There were uprisings, such as the Shays Rebellion, with mobs attacking courthouses and government buildings. There were regional tensions between the mercantile New England and the agrarian South. There were Crown loyalists to deal with, many of whom had fought against the Continental Army. And our first effort at a governing charter, the Articles of Confederation, failed. And it took 8 years of contentious debate before we finally adopted a constitution and inaugurated our first president. And unlike the people of Iraq, we did not have to face the added challenge of trying to recover from the trauma of decades of denial and brutal rule by a dictator like Saddam Hussein. The point is this: no nation in memory has made the transition from tyranny to a free society that's been immune to the difficulties and challenges of taking that path, not even our own. As Thomas Jefferson put it, we are not to expect to be translated from despotism to liberty in a feather bed. It's now 7 weeks since the liberation of Iraq, and the challenges are there. Just as it took time and patience, trial and error, and years of hard work before the founders got it right, so too it will take time and patience and trial and error and hard work for the Iraqi people to try to overcome the challenges that they face. This much is clear. We, the United States, has a stake in their success. For if Iraq, with its size and its capabilities, its resources and its history, is able to move towards a path of representative democracy, however bumpy the road may be, then the impact in the region and indeed in the world could be dramatic. Iraq could conceivably become a model, proof that a moderate Muslim state can succeed in the battle against extremism taking place in the Muslim world today. We are committed to helping the Iraqi people get on a path to a free society. We do not have an American template that we plan to impose on them. Iraqis will have to figure out how to build a free nation in a manner that reflects their unique culture and tradition.
Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld speaking earlier today at the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is WBU.